Chapter 7. The war was over in Korea. That camera, which caught every movement of everyone's life, was adjusted to run backward so that they were all returned to the point from which they had started out to war. Not all. Some, like Mavoli and Lembeck, remained where they had been dropped. The other members of Marco's INR patrol, whose minds believed in so many things that had never happened, although in that instance they were hardly unique, returned to their homes, left them, found jobs, and left them, until at last they achieved an understanding of their essential desperation and made peace with it, to settle down into making and acknowledging the need for the automatic motions that were called living. Marco didn't get back to the States until the spring of 1954, on the very first day of that spring. His temporary orders placed him with the First Army on Governor's Island in the New York Harbor, so he blandly took it for granted that he would be more than welcome to spend his stateside leave as Raymond's guest in Raymond's apartment. As far as Raymond was concerned, and this feeling mystified Raymond, Marco was more than welcome. Raymond lived in a large building on Riverside Drive, facing the commercially broad Hudson, at a point approximately opposite an electrical spectacular on the New Jersey shore which said S-P-R-Y. Some experiment in suggestive geriatrics, Raymond thought, to the démodé side of Manhattan Island. The apartment was on the 16th floor. It was old-fashioned, which meant that the rooms were large and light-filled, the ceilings high enough to permit a constant circulation of air, and the walls thick enough for a man and his loving wife to have a stimulating argument at the top of their lungs, without invading the nervous systems of surrounding neighbors. Raymond had rented the apartment furnished, and nothing in the place beyond the books, the records, and the phonograph was his. The bank issued rent checks for the apartment's use, as they paid all the bills for food, pressing, laundry, and liquor. These, the local merchants, sent directly to Raymond's very own bank officer, a Mr. Jack Rosenberg, a formidably bankerish sort of man, excepting for the somewhat disturbing habit of wearing leather tassels on his shoes. Raymond believed that the exchange of money was one of the few surviving methods people had for communicating with each other, and he wanted no part of it. The act of loving, not so much of the people themselves, but of the cherishment contained in the warm money passed from hand to hand, was to Raymond intimate to the point of being obscene, so that as much as possible he insisted that the bank take over that function, for which he paid them well. Each Monday morning at 10:15, a bank messenger came to Raymond's office with a sealed manila envelope containing 4 $20 bills, 4 $10 bills, 5 $5 bills, and 30 singles, a total of $175, for which Raymond would sign. This was his walking around money. He spent it, if he spent it, on books and offbeat restaurants, for he was a gourmet, as much as a man can be who eats behind a newspaper. His salary from the daily press of $135.81, after deductions, he mailed personally to the bank each Friday, and considered himself to be both lucky and shrewd, to be living in the biggest city on the Western continent for what he regarded as a net of $40 per week cash. The living expenses, rent, and such were the bank's problem. As much as possible, he ate every meal alone, excepting perhaps once a month, when he would be forced into accepting an invitation from O'Neill with some girls. All the men Raymond ever knew seemed to be able to summon up girls the way he might summon up a tomato juice from a waiter. Raymond was a theatrically handsome man, a well-informed man, and an intelligent one. He had never had a girl inside his large, comfortable apartment. He bought the sex he needed for $25 an hour, and he had never found it necessary to exceed that time period, although he filled it amply every time. Out of distaste, because she had suggested it herself the first time he had been there, and most certainly not out of any unconscious desire to be liked, he would give the maid who ran the towels $1.25 tip, because she had asked for $1, then would stare her down coldly when she thanked him. Raymond had found the retail outlet with efficiency. He had told the Broadway columnist on the paper that he would appreciate it greatly if one of the press agents with whom the columnist did business would secure him maximum for minimum accommodations atop some well-disposed, handsome, professional woman. Had he known that this ritual and the attendant expense were the direct result of the release conferred on him by Yun Lo in Tung Hua, he would have resented it, because although the money meant little to him, and although he enjoyed the well-disposed, handsome, professional woman very much, he would just as well have preferred to have remained in the psychological position of ignoring it. because it meant getting to bed on the evenings he was with her much later than he preferred to retire, and it most certainly had cut into his reading. Marco gave him no warning. He called Raymond at the paper and told him he would be in town for a while, that he would move in with Raymond, and they met at Hungarian Charlie's 15 minutes later. And that had been that. When Marco moved in, every one of Raymond's time and motion study habits was tossed high in the air to land on their heads. For 10 days or so, everything was turned upside down. Marco didn't believe in buying sex, because he said it was so much more expensive the other way, and he was loaded with loot. Drunk or sober, Marco found matched sets of pretty girls, bright and entertaining girls, rich girls, poor girls, and even one very religious set of sisters who insisted on getting up for church in the mornings, whether it was Sunday or not, then raced back to Marco's bed again. Marco had girls stashed in most of the rooms of Raymond's apartment whenever he thought it was a good idea, day and night, night and day, severely disturbing the natural rhythm of Raymond's life. There were too many cans of beer in the icebox and too few cans of V8. Men kept ringing the back doorbell, bringing boxes or paper bags filled with liquor or heavy paper sacks of ice cubes. Everybody seemed to be an expert on cooking spaghetti, and there was a film of red sauce on every white surface in the kitchen. In the foyer, in the living room, in the dining room, which Raymond had converted into an office, brassieres were strewn and slips, and amazingly small units of transparent panties. Marco made everyone wear shoes as a precaution against athlete's foot. He did not believe in hanging up his clothes when he was not in army service, because he said the agonizing reappraisal of the piles of clothing every morning in each room made him appreciate the neatness of army life all the more. The positive thing to be said for Marco was that although he crowded the apartment with girls and loud music and spaghetti and booze, he never invited any other guys. So what was there was 50% Raymond's. The women were all sizes and colors, sharing with each other only Marco's requisite of a good disposition, and he rarely hesitated to hand out a black eye if this rule were violated. Raymond found it enjoyable. He could not have stood it as a constant diet, and he believed that there were people who could stand it as a constant diet, and it was all extremely confusing to him at first, from his doctrinaire perspective, because the properly dressed, immaculately spoken women seemed to him to be the wantons, and the naked or near-naked babes who talked like longshoremen seemed to be there as professional comics or entertainers on the piano or on the long-distance telephone. They were talking, talking, always talking, but never with the unpleasant garrulity of Johnny Isolin. At first, when Raymond allowed himself to get around to feeling like having a little action for himself, he would grow flustered, be at a loss as to how to proceed, and he would close the door behind him in the converted dining room he called an office and try to forget about the whole thing. But that simply was not satisfactory. He did that the very first night that Marco had guests, and he sat there, nearly huddled up with misery, fearing that no one would ever come in to make him come out. But finally the door was flung open, and a small but strapping red-headed girl with a figure that made him moan to himself stood in the doorway and stared at him accusingly. "What the hell is the matter with you, honey?" she asked solicitously. "Are you queer?"
"Queer? Me?"
Strapping was definitely the word for this girl. Everything she had was big in miniature and in aching proportion. "There are 4 broads out there, honey," she said, "and 1 man. Marco took me aside and told me that there was 1 more in here, and although I ran right in here, I've been worrying all the way because what the hell are you doing in here with very, very ready broads out there?"
Well, you see..."
Raymond got up and took a slight step forward.
"I'd like to introduce myself."
The excitement was rising, and he forgot to think about himself. He was aware vaguely that this was the first time he had ever been courted, and if she could keep the thing within bounds, everything was going to be all right.
"I'm Raymond Shaw."
"So? I'm Winona Meehan. What his name's got to do with what Marco promised I would be doing if I came here? But now I find out I may have to stand in line like at Radio City on a Sunday night."
I guess I simply didn't know what else to say. "I'm just as avidly interested as you are," Raymond said. "But I guess... well, I suppose you could say I am shy. Or new at all this. Shy, anyway."